drifting lines all my life, and I've been living here for a long, long time, and I know it's been coming down a while now.
You're listening to the Kunstler Cast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl, featuring James Howard Kunstler, author of The Geography of Nowhere, The Long Emergency, and World Made by Hand. I'm Duncan Crary. Today's topic, The Glossary of Nowhere.
Hey, Jim.
Hi, Duncan. How are you?
I'm back.
How'd you turn up here? You just roll in under the cover of darkness or something?
Well, I've come here. I'm gonna put you to work today. I think one of the most powerful things you ever wrote was in the intro to The Geography of Nowhere, where you're explaining why it is you wrote this book. And I'm wondering if you could read that for our listeners.
All right. 30 years ago, Lewis Mumford said of post-World War II development, "The end product is an encapsulated life spent more and more either in a motor car or within the cabin of darkness before a television set." Unquote. The whole wicked, sprawling, megalopolitan mess, he gloomily predicted, would completely demoralize mankind and lead to nuclear holocaust. It hasn't come to that, but what Mumford deplored was just the beginning of a process that, instead of blowing up the world, has nearly wrecked the human habitat in America. Ever busy, ever building, ever in motion, ever throwing out the old for the new, we have hardly paused to think about what we are so busy building and what we have thrown away. Meanwhile, the everyday landscape becomes more nightmarish and unmanageable each year. For many, the word development itself has become a dirty word. 80% of everything ever built in America has been built in the last 50 years, and most of it is depressing, brutal, ugly, unhealthy, and spiritually degrading. The jive plastic commuter tract home wastelands, the Potemkin Village shopping plazas with their vast parking lagoons, the Lego block hotel complexes, the gourmet mansardic junk food joints, the Orwellian office parks, featuring buildings sheathed in the same reflective glass as the sunglasses worn by chain gang guards, the particle board garden apartments rising up in every meadow and cornfield, the freeway loops around every big and little city with their clusters of discount merchandise marts, the whole destructive, wasteful, toxic, agoraphobia-inducing spectacle that politicians proudly call growth. The newspaper headlines may shout about global warming, extinctions of living species, the devastations of rainforests, and other worldwide catastrophes, but Americans evince a striking complacency when it comes to their everyday environment and the growing calamity that it represents. I had a hunch that many other people find their surroundings as distressing as I do my own, yet I sense that they lack the vocabulary to understand what's wrong with the places. They ought to know best, and that's why I wrote this book.
Wow, do you remember that? That was 15 years ago you wrote that? Not much has changed since then.
I've changed, though. My brain has shrunk from too many more off-gassing carpets.
One thing you mentioned is that you wrote the book to give people a vocabulary to articulate their disgust with the suburban.
Well, I was struggling with it myself. You know, I actually went through a period, 10, 15 years before I wrote that book, of trying to formulate a vocabulary for myself to understand it. And, you know, I made several attempts to produce written essays on the subject, and I found myself repeatedly defeated, largely because, like a lot of other normal people who are affected by this, you know, I kept on defaulting to these style issues. You know, I didn't quite understand the physical form issues and the design issues. Really wasn't until I encountered, you know, Christopher Alexander and Andres Duany and many other contemporaries in the field that I began to really understand what I was talking about.
Well, Jim, would you mind if we do a little Kunstler glossary of terms of sorts?
Yeah, if you can come up with one, sure. I'll see what I can do.
All right. Well, I'll tell you. I'll sort of come up with the expression, and you explain to our listeners what it means. Okay. Let's start with parking lagoons. What are parking lagoons?
Well, that one was perhaps a little ironic because, you know, the word lagoon kind of evokes a lovely kind of tropical, place that you'd like to hang around, and you know, you're on your yacht, and you know, it's a lovely kind of place. Whereas the parking lot is the opposite of that. It's, you know, it's a demoralizing, yeah, repellent place. And so I was just trying to, you know, mess with people on that one.
You can park your yacht-sized car in the parking lot.
Right. Well, yeah, you sort of, that I think was an implication of it.
Okay, how about one-story UFOs?
I don't know if one story is even that important, because there are plenty of UFOs that are two stories. You know, no. I may have actually gotten that from somebody else, although I have no recollection of who it might have been. You know, but the whole idea was the development as UFO landing strip, you know, and the idea that, you know, you're actually not building anything, and certainly not anything memorable. You're just building a place for something out of this world to, you know, to put down on. And then the trouble is, of course, that they don't fly away.
Nature Band-Aids.
Oh, nature Band-Aids. Those are the little juniper shrub bark mulch ensembles, beloved of the landscaping profession, because they get paid a lot of money to install them. And that's the sort of default remedy for bad buildings. You know, you have a mutilated town with terrible buildings, you know, having been built in the last 30 years, the Burger Kings and all that crap. And you put a nature Band-Aid in front of it to both conceal the building if possible, you know, when the shrubs grow large enough, and also to make yourself feel better about being green. You know, I'm green. I'm good. I'm a good person with good intentions. You know, the whole thing's been a complete waste of time and money and effort. You know, if we put up buildings that were worth looking at in the first place, we wouldn't need the nature Band-Aids. An interesting exercise for those of you who still do foreign travel, you know, go to the plaza in front of the Pantheon in Rome. You know, it's a nicely proportioned outdoor public room, you know, with walls that are composed of the facades of the buildings around it. There's probably not one green thing within the whole ensemble. You know, there may be one flower box, but, you know, they understand in these other countries that you don't have to green everything up, that the architecture itself does the work of being wonderful.
Well, in a way, berms are kind of nature Band-Aids too, although they don't even include juniper shrubs and bark mulch beds. But it's so crazy when you go to these planning board meetings that they insist on a berm, as if whatever you're building is so hideous that it must have this barrier to obstruct your sight of it.
Well, absolutely. In fact, they usually do have plantings on them. That's the whole point. And they're called buffers. I think that's generically the name. Typologically, you know, the berm is one kind of buffer. And that's a raised kind of little esker that runs between the Kmart and the Walmart. And, you know, you put a bunch of birch trees on it, and that's supposed to make things all right. You know, one of the things I really love out here, it's one of my favorite, and this is, you know, putting my ironic hat on, one of my favorite constructions out here is they have this sort of Veterans Memorial Park between the Walmart and the Lowe's in the pod where all that stuff is. No one ever goes to it. I mean, it was just simply an exercise in grandiosity by the people up in Wilton, New York, you know. And they built a kind of semicircle of flags to show how much they care about their country, you know. And then they stick this thing on a scrap of land between the Walmart and the Kmart, and you know, it's just a ridiculous, it probably cost $300,000 and the taxpayers in the town, you know, paid for it.
Well, that brings us to our next term, which is patriotic totems.
Oh, well, I usually apply that to flagpoles, yeah. Because the idea is you put up a horrible building, like some corporate box, you know, some degrading piece of crap, and then you put an ensemble of three flags in front of it, which are not really there to show your patriotism. They're there to ward off criticism, because if you put a flag in front of something that brands it as, you know, being something you identify your culture with. And so, you know, you're not supposed to diss your own culture, because that's not nice. So that's why there are so many flags in front of the corporate buildings.
Yeah, it'd be like the state flag, the U.S. flag, and then the company flag or something like
that. Yeah, or the Canadian flag or something, you know, because they want to be nice to the Canadians who visit here. But it's always lower than the U.S. flag, of course.
So, Jim, what is the happy motoring scene?
Well, that it's the program. The happy motoring program is what we got in America for getting around. And it has been a good, you know, the thing is, it was really a wonderful It must have started out as a wonderful experience. I mean, imagine being in the United States in 1927, you know, when there were only, you know, a few million cars in the country. And, you know, the open road was really the open road. The countryside had not been screwed up with all this stuff. It must have been a wonderful experience for the first, you know, decade or two or three before World War II. And, of course, we had our own oil supply in this country, and it was really cheap, and it must have been just fabulous. But, of course, that's not the experience of our generation or your generation, which is just below mine. And, you know, with ours, you know, we got all the post-World War II crap, and so that changed everything. And you know, it was just a system that got totally out of control. And now, you know, now it's nearing its end. You know, we can't imagine living without it. And the whole thing is just tragic and awful. I think it's really important to make the point that, you know, that the whole Happy Motoring program was not a diabolical, you know, scheme worked up by the devil to make the American people unhappy. It really seemed like it would be a great thing in the early decades. And people, I think, were rightfully enthusiastic about it. They just didn't really, they just couldn't tell how out of control it would get. And it's sad.
The topics that you write about are really depressing and soul-crushing, but they're funny. Like, when I first went to see you speak, I was cracking up. Every time you talk about bark mulch beds and universe rubs, I still laugh. It's funny.
Well, it's very simple. You know, as I actually said in the first chapter of Home from Nowhere, you know, quoting Samuel Beckett, nothing is funnier than unhappiness. You know, when you go see a Laurel and Hardy movie, you know, Laurel and Hardy are hitting each other with 2x4s and dropping pianos on each other and, you know, running each other over in their Model T Fords. You know, that's not happy stuff, but we laugh at it. You know, it's hilarious. You know, if they were giving each other flowers or, you know, sitting at a good restaurant having a wonderful meal, that wouldn't be funny at all.
Yeah.
But, you know, comedy is all about people being uncomfortable.
So, Jim, what's with your expression, it's all good? Where did that come from? What is that?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, you know, I attracted a certain number of correspondents, you know, people who were writing to me, you know, writing fan letters, readers. And there was this one particular guy who I still correspond with regularly after 7 years. And he's a very interesting cat. He's sort of he's a Vietnam veteran Zen master kind of personality. And he introduced me to the term, it's all good. You know, he meant it kind of ironically, and I took it that way. And I thought it was fun. He when he signed off on his letters, he always drew a happy face with, you know, the slitty little eyes and the smile. And so it just seemed to be about the best way to sum up the American experience of our time.
When I saw it, it reminded me of, I was showing you before we started recording for the listeners out there, I've got the R. Crum handbook, and right after A Short History of America, the cartoon series, there's a quote. You're quoted in the book.
Yeah, I didn't even know that until you showed that to me today, but I'm very honored to be in R. Crum's book because he's a great genius of our time.
Yeah, the alternative cartoonist, for those of you listening. And right after that, right next to your quote, there's a picture of this guy just sitting on like a milk carton in this dumpy abandoned yard. He goes, I just sort of went with the flow, man.
Yeah, right. Well, Crum really he's really got our number. And notice, by the way, he moved to France about 10 years ago. You know, I think that he finally realized, you actually don't have to put up with this if you got enough dough.
Okay, Jim, well, thanks for going through that lesson. I hope all you listeners are ready for the pop quiz they're going to have on the glossary terms. So thanks a lot, Jim.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, this is Brad from Cincinnati, Ohio, and I have to agree with what you said about architects. It's kind of a sad reflection on the profession when the greatest architecture that was ever made was all made before there was any formalized training in architecture. It's not like medicine where the greatest, you know, surgeries of all time ever happened before there was formalized training in surgery. It's the exact opposite. So when your entire profession revolves around gradually getting worse at what you do through formalized training, that's normally a bad sign.
You've been listening to the Kunstler Cast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can download episodes of this program, read transcripts, learn about our theme music, and join our mailing list at kunstlercast.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.